Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of war, violence, murder, torture, rape, sexual assault, slavery, and infanticide.
During Charles XII's time in the Ottoman domain, the Great Northern War entered a new stage. It became a war of attrition, and in many ways, it was also a war for survival, for the smaller peoples who comprised the Swedish Empire. In southern Sweden, northern Germany, and Finland, new combinations of enemies were seeking to divvy up the vulnerable Swedish Empire as Charles recovered in exile. Russian forces followed up their triumph at Poltava by besieging and then capturing Riga in 1710. This effectively ended Swedish resistance east of the Vistula River. Russian designs now centered on Finland, and during a short siege in 1710, the city of Vyborg was captured. This opened the proverbial door to the rest of Finland, and in 1712, Russia began the first of many military campaigns designed to capture the land and its people. They tore a path of devastation through Finland, and by 1713, they had captured the capital of Helsinki. Swedish manpower was stretched beyond the breaking point. The state apparatus was forced into defending the many enclaves and outposts Sweden possessed. As a result, they were unable to focus on a single front. In Finland, there were only 7,000 infantry and 3,000 cavalry defending against a Russian invasion of over 20,000. In spite of their lack of manpower, Swedish forces flustered the Russians until 1714, when the Swedes were decisively defeated in the Battle of Napu. What followed is remembered in Finnish history as the Isohiva, or the Big Hatred. Russian forces occupying Finland began a reign of terror, raping, torturing, enslaving the people there. Some historians even argue this also constituted a genocide against the Finnish population. The region was already devastated by years of warfare and plagues, which especially decimated the populations of the major cities. In one plague outbreak, it is estimated that upwards of half the population of Helsinki perished from disease. Russian troops were responsible for several infamous massacres. At Heliotto, as many as 800 Finnish civilians were tortured and killed by Russian units in a spontaneous massacre. The youngest victim was only 8 days old. Tens of thousands of Finns were subject to deportation, forced labor, and enslavement. Some ended up in Persian trafficking markets, where the Finnish genetic trait of having blonde hair and blue eyes was considered quote-unquote exotic by many Persian traffickers. Perhaps as many as 20,000 Finns were trafficked, with many being subject to sexual exploitation and torture at the hands of their captors. Around 1,400 Finns were forcibly conscripted into the Russian army as well. Of these, only 400 would return home. Unsurprisingly, a rebellion began to spread across the countryside. Finns took up arms against their oppressors and launched highly successful guerrilla operations against them. These freedom fighters were led by Tapani Loffing, who kept a diary of his engagements during the Big and Little Hates. the one place in which Swedish forces could still seriously contend with their Russian counterparts was on the waves. The Swedish Navy still controlled the naval theater of war, and they ensured that the Baltic remained a Swedish lake, at least for now. Unfortunately for the Swedes, the Russian Navy was growing stronger every day, and they were soon able to muster a massive fleet of almost 100 separate galleys. The Swedish Navy was smaller, but fielded much larger vessels and more experienced seamen. They were threatened by the Russian fleet and retreated around the Hanko Peninsula, hoping reinforcements would soon arrive. The Russian fleet would try and destroy this force on August 7, 1714. The Swedish fleet fell back further into a virtual bottleneck between two Finnish islands. The calm weather that day benefited the Russian Navy, since their smaller boats were more maneuverable than the larger Swedish ones. What happens after this is highly contested. Either the Swedes resisted in a day-long fight, inflicting thousands of casualties upon the Russians, or the Russians launched a single concerted attack on the Swedes and overwhelmed them, while losing relatively few men. It seems the Russian version of events is more likely, since Swedish sources claim they killed more Russians than the number of Russians present for battle. Regardless, the outcome was the same in both tellings of the tale. The Swedish Navy, which had hitherto protected Finnish shores, was completely destroyed or captured by the Russians. These captured Swedish vessels, as well as the crews, were paraded through St. Petersburg as proof of Russian naval supremacy. In 1720, the Swedish and Russian navies would come to blows once more around the islands of Åland. Coming to a draw, the two navies retreated following an inconclusive engagement, in which both sides likely lost around the same number of men. The Swedes were once again heavily outnumbered, but this time their firepower was effective against the smaller Russian craft. However, the Russian Navy managed to capture several Swedish warships, as well as over 400 sailors. This was the last major naval engagement of the Great Northern War. In southern Sweden, Danish designs were set on Scania, the province lost to them in the Scanian War. They invaded the province, hoping to recapture it. They were opposed by a Swedish army of 14,000. The two forces of similar strength met around Helsingborg. A thick fog covered the Swedish advance, and when it lifted, it was revealed that the Swedes had inadvertently maneuvered themselves into a terrific flanking position. The Danish commander attempted to rectify this situation, but the Danish left was now at risk of being enveloped. The units stationed here began retreating. This opened holes in the Danish battle formations, which Swedish units rapidly exploited. At one point, the Danish commander was wounded, destroying Danish cohesion. The fight rapidly descended into a confused melee in which determined Swedish cavalry charges won the day against Danish resistance. The results were devastating for the Danes. They had lost 5,000 men killed and wounded, as well as another 2,600 prisoners. This was around half of their invading force. The Swedes lost 3,000 men killed and wounded. The Battle of Helsingborg holds the distinction as being the last major battle fought on Swedish soil during the Great Northern War. There would be raids, but the Allies would never again attempt to attack Sweden on their home turf. The Allies largely focused on Sweden's Germanic provinces instead. Starting in 1711, the Swedish fortress of Stralsund was besieged by a massive coalition army of 55,000. The garrison of barely 11,000 resisted for years and continually frustrated the armies of Prussia, Russia, Saxony, and Denmark. They resisted until relief came in the form of a reinforcing Swedish army. This army met a combined force of Saxon, Danish, and Prussian units around Gadesbusch. Swedish General Magnus Stenbock roused his men with a short speech in which he said, quote, "Now you see your enemies before you. Do you wish to get at them and show your love for the king and fatherland?" Unquote. His soldiers responded with a resounding "Ja!" They held their fire until they were within 12 paces of the Danish. They proceeded to lay a murderous fire against their foe, and then charged emphatically against the rows and rows of Allied infantry. The Allies were forced to retreat. The battlefield was now in Swedish hands, and the Allied retreat caused havoc amongst their units. By the end of the day, over 6,000 Allies were killed, wounded, or captured, while a similar fate befell 1,600 Swedes. The Battle of Godsbusch helped secure Pomerania for the Swedes, but their hold on northern Germany proved to be only temporary. Stenbock and his army were pursued by a much larger force all throughout the region until they were finally cornered in the fortress of Tönning. They were besieged here by a Russian army of 36,000. It was the first recorded instance of Russian military intervention in central Germany. For over a year, Stenbock's army and the city's garrison resisted the Russians until they were finally compelled to surrender to a combined Russian-Danish force. Stralsund was practically all that was left of the Swedish Empire in mainland Europe. It was here that Charles rode into the city after his famous two-week escapade through Europe. He immediately energized the garrison and was largely responsible for their continued resistance until 1715. Charles refused to head back to Sweden proper, hoping his presence in North Germany would draw attention away from Sweden. It was only now, when everything was lost, and the Swedish Empire was little more than a shell of its former self, that Charles finally began exploring a peace deal in which Sweden lost territory. Unfortunately, it was too little, too late. Charles then tried to form an alliance with France, a nation of which he had hitherto been wary. But France had only just finished the War of Spanish Succession. They were in no mood to face off against another coalition. Charles also reached out to the Holy Roman Empire, but the fractured nature of the state meant little headway could be made. Finally, in July of 1715, a massive 50,000-man army consisting of Russian and Danish troops marched to Stralsund. This was a determined push which Charles could not hope to resist, especially if he did not control the vital island of Rügen. Aware of the island's importance, Charles had around 2,800 cavalry and infantry stationed there. A joint Russo-Prussian-Danish force of 22,000 attempted to dislodge them. Their first attempt at storming the island was called off due to Swedish preparedness, but the second landing succeeded in disembarking at Stresau on November 5, 1715. In the hopes of throwing the Allies back into the sea, Charles rushed reinforcements to the threatened town. Swedes attempted to storm the Danish positions to their front, but they were flung back with serious casualties. Attempting to reform, the Swedes were surprised by a Danish cavalry sortie, and Charles had his horse shot out from under him. Charles was clearly frustrated, and he exclaimed, quote, "Is God not on my side anymore?" Unquote. As if to answer his question, he was struck in the chest by a bullet as he attempted to rally his men before being forcibly carried away from the battlefield. The Swedes proceeded to retreat from the battlefield in good order. Michael Glaser says the Battle of Stresau, quote, "holds the distinction of being his, Charles's, first defeat while in command." Unquote. The fourth bullet Charles had ever taken in battle turned out to not be life-threatening. Stralsund was now surrounded and completely cut off from the outside world, save for the sea. Charles seemed to be at his wit's end. He offered new terms for peace, promising to give up several of Sweden's German possessions and even recognize Augustus as King of Poland. All these entreaties fell on deaf ears. Charles led one final sortie against the Allies, attempting to recapture the outer defenses of Stralsund. Although this attack failed, It gave the Swedish garrison the time it needed to successfully extricate itself from the besieged city by sea. Charles landed on Swedish soil around Skar on December 13, 1715. It was his first time being in Sweden since 1700. Somehow, Charles maintained an outward show of optimism. Upon his return, he wrote, quote, "I am still convinced that we will find ways to return everything to as it was before," unquote. Charles did not rest. He built up a small army in southern Sweden, and starting in February of 1716, he began his first Norwegian campaign. Michael Glaser says the campaign was launched in order to, quote, "force Denmark out of the coalition for a second time, divert enemy forces from a planned invasion of southern Sweden, allow Swedish troops to sustain themselves again on foreign soil at little cost to the treasury, and keep the British fleet closer to their own isles, and therefore out of the Baltic," unquote. The first Norwegian campaign began with four separate movements designed to confuse the Danish-Norwegian forces opposing the Swedes. Charles moved with the majority of his troops in two separate columns, bound for the Norwegian capital of Christiania. They captured the city on March 10, 1716, but all was not well along the Swedish supply route. The strategically important fortress of Akershus was still resisting a Swedish siege. This made a land supply route dangerous, while the Danes controlled the waves, making a sea-based route hazardous. Additionally, the Norwegian population of Christiania refused to assist their occupiers. These factors forced Charles into abandoning the Norwegian capital. The Swedes moved on to the town of Fredrikshald and captured it briefly, but their position was tenuous. The fortress of Fredriksten loomed large over the Swedish position, and an attempt at assaulting the walls failed on July 4th. This, coupled with a Danish naval raid on the Swedish supply route, forced Charles into abandoning the Norwegian campaign altogether and returning to the Swedish border. He promised further action and believed he failed to make significant progress in Norway only because he lacked the necessary manpower to do so. Back on the home front, defensive plans were being laid and trenches dug for the impending invasion of the Swedish mainland. Peter's galley fleet was devastating the coastal towns of Sweden. The Allies spent their energy on preparing for this final attack and scheming up ways to capture and gobble up whatever remained. The only thing that saved mainland Sweden from a massive invasion in 1716 was the mistrust and bickering of the Allied powers. Danish and Saxon statesmen were growing weary of Peter and the newfound Russian Empire. They saw the invasion of Sweden as a way for Peter to further the interests of his Russian nation at the expense of his own allies. In the 11th hour, the bickering of the Allies proved too much, and there was such distrust between them that Peter called off the invasion entirely. Besides being wary of his allies, Peter had become wary of invading Sweden. Meanwhile, conspiracies were being hatched by Sweden's top diplomats. They covertly reached out to the Jacobins of England. The Jacobins were a radical sect of British people who pushed for the return of Catholic rule to England. To attempt to return Britain to Catholic dominance, they launched several rebellions over the course of the late 17th and early 18th century. Baron Kort, one of Sweden's chief diplomats, was one of the main people pushing for Jacobin support, and it seems likely that Charles was aware of his administrator's duplicity, although the king's involvement was cursory at best. Gortz enjoyed the confidence of the king, but he had no love from the people, nor from fellow politicians who saw his meteoric rise as a threat to their positions. He strictly enforced taxation, which was already high, and this gained him many enemies amongst the common man. Moreover, his anti-British conspiracy alienated him in the courts of Hanover and London. Many British pressmen and propagandists began sending out pamphlets degrading the king and attempting to ruin his reputation. In the short amount of downtime between his two Norwegian campaigns, Charles and his army resided in Lund, the site of his father's famous battle. In the nearby college, Charles studied arithmetic and philosophy. He also gave his blessing to his sister Ulrika Eleonora to marry Frederick of Hesse-Kassel, while continuously dodging questions about his own future and possible marriage options. 1717 passed with no major land engagements, and the same was true for the first half of 1718. This time was spent drilling and initiating new soldiers into the army. From the hollowed-out shell of an army which existed when Charles returned to Sweden, he now had a force 65,000 strong. They were dispersed across Swedish territory, with many being sent north to guard the Finnish frontier. Finally, Minister Gortz managed to negotiate a major prisoner swap with the Russians. In return for Russian officers, held captive since Narva, officers like Reinskjold were welcomed back into the Swedish fold. One man who was not included in the prisoner exchanged was Lowenhaupt, who Charles blamed for his surrender in Russia. He would die a prisoner of war a year later. Once more, Charles endeavored to subdue Norway, and once more he split his army up to do so. A shift in Swedish tactics was necessary. The war had devastated the population of horses in Sweden, causing two-thirds of his army to be infantry-based. Charles proved once more that he was a master of launching feints and misdirecting the opposition. His progress through Norway was rapid. His enemies were caught off guard by the fast movements of several large forces. The most northern of these feints was sent to the frigid Scandinavian mountains, where they were expected to preoccupy any northern reinforcements. In no time at all, Charles was back in front of Frederiksten, the fort which had repelled the Karelians 2 years ago. On November 24, 1718, the Swedish army began construction of their first trenches. On November 30th, Swedish engineers began prepping a second line of trenches, designed to further encroach upon Danish-Norwegian positions. The fort was already suffering from lack of supply, and a paltry garrison of only 1,400 defended it. Michael Glaser says, quote, "Positive projections estimated the fall of the fortress in a week's time." At 6 p.m., Charles was in the trenches with his men, while this quote-unquote new trench was being constructed. Charles got up on the original line of trenches, his arms holding up the rest of his body. This exposed the head and shoulders of Charles to incoming enemy fire, but this had never bothered him before. He always insisted on being present during construction of dangerous trench lines like this, in which dozens of casualties had already been reported. Charles felt his presence inspired his men and helped them work more efficiently. Being the start of winter, the sun was already down, and the moonlight was blocked by cloud coverage. For several hours, Charles sat and watched the construction of the new trench line, using his elbows to prop up his chin. He was asked repeatedly by officers present to get down, but each entreaty was met with a dismissive wave of his hand and the words, quote, "Do not be afraid," unquote. Around 9 o'clock, a projectile passed through the side of his head and killed him instantly. His foot slipped from the footholds he had made along the trench, while the front of his body fell limp over the parapet. Cries of, "Lord Jesus, the king is shot," unquote, reverberated amongst the officers as the king's body was hastily taken down and his bullet wound discovered. Contrary to romantic descriptions, the death of Charles was kept secret, with Swedish high command insisting the trench where the king died be sealed off. Stretcher bearers took the king's body, his face hidden from view, to Swedish headquarters. The uneven roads caused the men carrying the king to fall. Charles's body rolled unceremoniously off the stretcher, revealing to those around who had died. As word spread around the camp, a wooden coffin was hastily constructed and used to transport the king's body to his personal physician, who embalmed the king and prepared his body for a royal funeral. On February 26, 1719, Charles XII was solemnly laid to rest in a black marble sarcophagus. His tomb was fittingly placed across from the tomb of Gustav II Adolf, Sweden's other warrior king. Charles was dead at 36. He holds the distinction of being the last European monarch to die in battle. Almost immediately, questions began to arise about the king's death. Was he really killed by an enemy projectile? Or was the king killed by his own people? This debate, as well as a debate surrounding the type of projectile which killed the king, has been raging since his royal burial. Speculation surrounding the nature of the king's death was further fueled by autopsies carried out by the Swedish state. There is a surprising amount of evidence in support of these two theories, both in the form of witness testimony and physical data. As far as the officers who stood beside the king when he died were concerned, the shot was fired by the enemy, and none of them considered foul play as the cause of the king's death. Another bystander considered the hole in the king's head to be, quote, too large, unquote, to have been made by a, quote-unquote, normal bullet. He believed canister or grape shot fired from an enemy cannon killed the king. This argument is further bolstered by X-rays done on the king's remains in 1917. These X-rays showed lead was still in the king's foot from the wound he received prior to Poltava. However, no lead was discovered inside the king's head. Unfortunately, these answers lead to more questions. Those who support the theory that the king's own men killed him claim this evidence points to the use of a special, quote-unquote, jacketed bullet, which would have left no lead upon its entrance or exit through the skull. However, it's important to stress that the lead could have been skillfully removed by the Royal Swedish surgeon. In addition to medical evidence supporting this theory, there are two separate damning confessions, both made by Swedes. These admissions were made by the adjutant to the future Swedish King Frederick, as well as Karl Kronstadt, the head of the Swedish artillery, who was hitherto a decorated and respected officer. Both men admitted to their role in killing Charles while they were experiencing bouts of illness and fever, so many speculate these confessions hold little merit. But Kronstadt's confession seemed genuine enough to convince historians like Karl Nordling, who points out that Kronstadt was closely associated with Frederick and the Hessel-Kessel faction at court. If true, these admissions point to a large-scale conspiracy within Sweden. In the aftermath of the king's death, several things occurred in rapid succession. Ulrika Eleonora was elevated to the position of queen, and Minister Gortz became a scapegoat for all of Sweden's woes and was brought up on false charges of treason. In the end, he was beheaded by jealous politicians who were upset at Gortz for his meteoric rise. Finally, the Second Norwegian Campaign was cancelled. In the far north of the Swedish-Norway frontier, Swedish forces who were stationed there began what is remembered as the Karelian Death March. Thousands of Swedes and Finns were hopelessly lost in the mountains when a massive blizzard struck, further disorienting them. On the first night of their march, 200 men froze to death. Over the course of the next week, a further 3,000 men froze in place. Arriving in a small village on the night of January 4th into the 5th, they found a modicum of relief, but even here, 600 died. They traveled further into the whiteout towards Dovid, where another 700 men froze. Only 2,100 Swedes survived the march, and of these, over 600 were crippled for life. The question of the king's death continued to gnaw at the Swedish population. This controversy led to repeated openings of the king's tomb in 1746, 1859, and finally, in 1917, the remains of Charles were examined by Swedish scientists and doctors. The first autopsy seemed to confirm the homicide theory. The 1859 autopsy muddied the waters and leaned more in favor of death at the hands of the enemy. The final autopsy utilized newer technology and threw a monkey wrench into the homicide theory. This autopsy concluded that the shot had to have come from the left, which was the direction in which the enemy fort was positioned. Furthermore, the autopsy indicated that the shot had to come from a slight elevation, further pointing toward the king being killed by the enemy as opposed to his own men. Finally, the debate as to the sort of weapon which killed Charles is as heated as the debate over who fired the trigger. It is largely agreed that a pistol could not have fired the round. This was due to the short range pistols had during the era. This left a musket ball, a jacketed bullet, or a canister/grape shot as likely candidates. In the 1940s, the strangest theory of them all came from Albert Sandcliffe. He postulated that Charles was killed by a bullet fashioned from a button which once belonged to him. It was further postulated that this was done because there was a serious belief that Charles could not die from being hit by a quote-unquote normal bullet. This theory is largely dismissed, but it cannot be completely discounted. Both of these debates lend credence to the conclusion drawn by historian Michael Roberts when he says, quote, "It is best that historians leave the theorizing alone. It is simply not worth the time," unquote. Although the death of Charles was tragic for Sweden at the time, his living was probably the only thing which stood between Sweden and peace. He was probably one of the few people left in Sweden who wanted to continue the war, and if he had succeeded in Norway, Michael Glaser says, quote, "It is likely Charles would have returned to mainland Europe," unquote. The death of Charles and Gortz also repaired the damaged relations between Sweden and Great Britain. Great Britain came to realize that in order to curb Russian power in the East, they needed a stable Swedish nation. They began pushing for an end to the Great Northern War by dissuading Hanover and Denmark from launching further attacks into Sweden proper. In 1720, Sweden and Prussia signed a peace treaty. Sweden gave up much of Pomerania, but still retained a sizable portion of the province, which they controlled until the Napoleonic Wars. Denmark was next. They got Sweden to renounce all relations with the Duchy of Holstein-Gottorp and forced them to pay tolls on the Danish Strait, from which they were hitherto exempt. Denmark retained Holstein-Gottorp until 1864, when the land was ceded to Prussia and Austria, and set the stage for the German Brothers' War. Peter, who was once eager to get peace and even cede territory to Sweden, now wanted to dictate peace on his own terms, relinquishing nothing to Sweden. In response, Sweden tried and failed to form an anti-Russian alliance with France, Great Britain, and the Holy Roman Empire, but each nation backed away from any serious agreement. Swedish forces would win a sole victory against the Russians at Staket, but besides this, the Swedish coastline was at the absolute mercy of Russian raiding parties. Finally, in 1721, the Treaty of Nystad was signed between Russia and the Swedish Empire. Sweden would cede and never regain the Baltic provinces, Kexholm and Ingria, though they managed to retain Finland. This was only a temporary retention, however, as Sweden would lose Finland through repeated wars with Russia over the next 100 years. This officially ended the bloodiest war in Swedish history. In total, over 800,000 people on both sides were killed or died as a result of the war. Besides deciding the future of the Swedish nation, the Great Northern War decided the future of the entire eastern half of Europe. In Sweden, the secession crisis was becoming a serious burden on the state. Ulrika Eleonora claimed the throne but had to contend with the estates of the clergy, the burghers, and the peasantry. In order to gain their support, she would have to renounce absolutism and write a constitution which called for the election of all future Swedish monarchs. The end of the Great Northern War and the ascension of Ulrika I is considered by Swedish historians to be the beginning of the Age of Freedom, which Michael Glaser points out, quote, coincides with the larger European Enlightenment, unquote. Ulrika I reigned for several years. During that time, she attempted to form a joint reign with her husband Frederick. When this failed, she abdicated in her husband's favor, leading to the ascension of Frederick I as the new Swedish king. Summing up this period of Sweden's history, a famous epigram was written, which goes, quote, the glory of the age is past and gone. We to our former nothingness are fated. King Charles is dead, King Frederick consecrated, and Sweden's clock has moved from 12 to 1. Unquote. Sweden ceased being a true world power and they turned inward. Instead of focusing on military expansion and foreign dragons to slay, Sweden focused on the rights of their people and the progress of their country. They began to see Charles as an outdated and bloodthirsty brute. This is demonstrated in the August Strindberg play, Karl XII, which depicts the king and his rule as one of violence and death at the expense of the Swedish people as a whole. This view was not universal by any means. There were plenty of Swedish jingos and military men who saw the reign of Charles as the last gasp of glory for Sweden, as well as something to be emulated. This is best seen in the reign of Gustavus III, who oversaw several military campaigns against Russia and failed each time to regain lost ground, ultimately losing all of Finland to Russia. As World War threatened to engulf Scandinavia, the example of Charles was held up once more as either a warhound or someone to be emulated. One who loved the example of Charles was Adolf Hitler. He felt that Charles was the pinnacle of Gothic excellence, both in military matters and in lifestyle choices. Hitler even had a statue of Charles brought to his personal residence. The fact that his Russian campaign devolved into a war of attrition, similarly to Charles, should not be lost on anyone. In Sweden, fascists there tried and failed to uphold the military virtues of Charles, attempting to join the war with Russia on the side of the Germans. Fortunately, Swedish politicians refused such provocative arguments, and the Swedish homeland became a prime destination for Jewish refugees fleeing genocide. In total, 8,000 Jewish people found a temporary home in Sweden, but this is nothing of the callousness of certain Swedish politicians and far-right groups who did all they could to prevent Jewish migration in the 1930s and early 1940s. Sweden may no longer be an empire, but this status has done nothing to hinder the development of Swedish society, science, art, and culture. Since the death of Charles, Swedish standards of living have improved exponentially, and with the rise of the Swedish welfare state, these numbers have only continued to improve. Education, healthcare, and average happiness are all at or near the top, especially when compared to the rest of the world. Sweden has proved that the way forward does not lay in military expansion nor the strangulation of the rights of those deemed quote-unquote different. Instead, the Swedish nation has shown that countries are only truly great when they focus on a deliberate tax plan, uphold education and healthcare as basic human rights, respect the rights of workers and unions, and maintain equality for all their citizens. In Russia, Peter I was busy searching for new quote-unquote traitors to torture, and he did not have to search for long. He sent a letter to his son which essentially told him to shape up or he would be removed as heir. Upon receiving this letter, Peter's son Alexei fled the country rather than adjust his attitude. In truth, he wanted nothing to do with being Russian sovereign and never had the stomach for it. He hid out in Austria, where he received intelligence documents from the empire about his father's intentions. While these documents contained seemingly innocuous information, these letters, as well as incriminating documents found upon Alexei's lover, would provoke Peter to take vengeance on his own child. He had his son tortured before his very eyes and demanded to know why he was working with foreign countries and what plot he had laid with his mother, Eudoxia. Alexei received 40 lashes from a cat of nine tails, and the internal damage resulted in his death later that day. Eudoxia was tracked down. She had fled the convent she was forced to join and was living with another man. The man was broken on the wheel, and before dying, he spit in Peter's face. Peter's life continued, but he suffered from intense bladder problems. He was unable to urinate for days at a time. Later in life, it was discovered that he had massive kidney stones blocking his urethra. They had to be dislodged, and the only way to do so was to shove a needle down Peter's urethra. Two doctors stood at the Tsar's side, while a third administered the operation. The pain was intense, but Peter did not shout or scream. Instead, Michael W. Simmons says, quote, "he broke the hands of the two doctors propping him up," unquote. Following Peter's death, due to similar bladder complications and infection, his wife Catherine ascended as Empress of Russia. She would only be the sovereign for a few years. Paul II, who was a relative of both Peter the Great and Charles XII, would replace her. Charles XII and his exploits fell into legend. Charles the Butcher, the Defender, the Soldier, the Devoted Brother, and King of Sweden. These titles and stories, muddled with inaccuracies, were all that remained of the sovereign of Sweden. He was a man who became a symbol. A symbol which is remembered in countless portraits and statues. One of the most famous of which is John Peter Molin's bronze rendering of the king. The statue shows a Charles at the height of his powers. His hand is rested upon the hilt of his sword, while his other hand is outstretched and pointing east towards Russia. The recent Swedish decision to join NATO, while being inspired largely by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, was also inspired by centuries of enmity between Sweden and Russia. This decision has the potential to pave the way towards a future conflict between Sweden and Russia. With any hope, and perhaps with God on our side, this conflict will never occur, and the conflicts and genocide already raging in Ukraine, Palestine, Myanmar, Sudan, Lebanon, Mexico, and West Africa will conclude with peace, reparations, and justice. Thank you all so much for listening to this deep dive on the history of the Great Northern War. Learning about history is sometimes frustrating, taxing, and horrible. In some instances, bad actors on either side of a debate will attempt to gloss over the horrors of history for specific reasons. In learning about this conflict, I saw the intense amount of propaganda from all sides and how that propaganda continues to influence these political entities today. Polish nationalists refused to recognize Stanislaus I as the quote-unquote true king in their histories. Early Swedish historians greatly exaggerate Russian strength, and Russian chroniclers are deceptive when detailing massacres committed by their troops. If this proves anything, it is that history is truly alive, constantly repeating itself while people of all different schools of thought rewrite it. Charles is a perfect example of how revisionist history could be dangerous. He's an example of how leaving out the important bits of information can frame anyone in the scope of the writer or viewer while muddling the complete truth. War is forged by men, not godlike figures with superhuman strength or wit or depth. And it is almost always brought about by those who feel they have something to prove. The reality is that the human being behind the majestic Carolean outfit, Charles XII, was no different from you or me. And that is sometimes the most difficult pill to swallow. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode in this series of Turning Tides. In the next episode, we begin a new series set in the humid forests and rivers of La Plata in South America. At around the same time as the United States Civil War was winding down, the conflict which would decide the fate of the southern end of the American landmass was just beginning. The small inland republic of Paraguay, led by the dictator Francisco Solano López, would begin a war against Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay. Their surprise invasion would begin the War of the Triple Alliance, or simply, the Paraguayan War. Check it out next time, and if you haven't already, make sure you subscribe to the growing Turning Tides YouTube channel and the social media podcast page. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone, and I hope you all have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, M-O-V-O-P-H-O-T-O. Thank you again.